Chapter 1. Hannibal stepped into the CIA's Office of Asian Pacific, Latin American, and African Analysis. "I'm here to see Director Berti," he said. "Hannibal, have a seat. What brings you by?"
"I'd like your opinion on William Burke. I'd like to recruit him."
"Billy?"
"He's the CIA's station chief in Laos.
Billy's direct contact is Lieutenant General Ryong Law.
He commands the CIA's covered army in Laos. Billy's other direct contact is Ambassador Popinot. He oversees Project 321. It's run out of the American Embassy in Vientiane. Are you familiar with the project?" Hannibal replied, "The Pentagon created the program to allow military personnel to operate covertly in Laos as civilian volunteers."
"I'm more interested in the man, not so much his career."
"Well, Billy's a typical lifer. He doesn't have a wife or children. His supervisors decided early in Billy's career to keep him in the field for precisely those reasons. The CIA works hard to keep Billy challenged, and he hasn't disappointed."
"How's Burke with agents and assets?"
"Billy maximizes their potential and value. That's another reason why his supervisors have kept him in the field."
"It's why the CIA sent Billy to Laos. Did Billy ask to work for you?"
"No.
The company picks, screens, and approves recruits before it contacts them. The company is heavily recruiting returning military personnel for work in Asia. Many of them worked in Project 321. That's how Burke came to my attention." Berti said, "I recommend that you speak with General Law and Ambassador Popinot. They'll give you a better insight into the man. I hate to lose Billy."
"Still, any work that he's assigned after Laos will be a step down for him, and we'd probably lose Billy anyway." Billy was working at a Hmong base camp in the northern Laotian mountains when Major Jenkins arrived.
"Burke," Jenkins said. "The colonel wants to see you back at headquarters. Take your stuff. I don't think you're coming back. The colonel told me to finish up here. How am I supposed to get back?"
Billy asked.
"The same way that I got here. Walk." Colonel Withy looked up from his work when Billy entered his tent. "Burke, Ambassador Popinot wants to see you.
Catch the next flight to Vientiane.
Be at the embassy tomorrow morning."
"What's so urgent?"
"I don't know. Just be there and take your stuff. You're not coming back." Billy entered the American embassy at noon.
He told the receptionist, "I have an appointment with the ambassador."
"I'm late." The receptionist placed a call, after which she said, "The ambassador's secretary will be here in a moment." The ambassador's secretary opened the ambassador's private dining room door and escorted Billy into the room.
"Billy," Ambassador Popinot said.
"I wondered when you'd get here. Have you had lunch?"
"No," Billy replied.
"Well, sit. We can talk while we eat."
Billy asked, "What did you want to see me about?"
"Someone in DC wants to meet you."
"Who?"
"I don't have that information. Tomorrow you'll fly back to Langley. Director Berti will brief you. See my secretary for your particulars. Now, let's enjoy our lunch."
48 hours after Billy left the American Embassy in Vientiane, he stepped into Director Berti's office at CIA headquarters. Director Berti told Billy, "Congratulations."
He stood to shake Billy's hand. Then both men sat.
Billy leaned back in his chair and asked, "What brings me back to Langley?"
"No one seems to know. Someone wants to speak with you. Here's the restaurant's name and address where you'll meet, and the time." Director Berti placed a piece of paper on his desk and slid it toward Billy.
Billy took a few seconds to study the director's face before asking, "Can't you give me more information, and why all the secrecy?"
Director Berti picked up a pen. He leaned back in his chair and twirled it in his fingers. Finally he replied, "Most likely you'll be offered a job."
"Why me?"
"Why now? Who?" Director Berti stopped twirling his pen and placed it on his desk. He leaned forward and replied, "I can't give you all the answers that you're seeking.
I don't have access to that information.
The crowd that's interested in you doesn't officially exist anywhere in our government."
"They're there, of course, but no one will acknowledge their existence, and no one will speak of them, especially not to you."
Billy knew the director had no intention of discussing the matter further.
"All right," he said. Billy reached for the paper with the address on it. As he got up to leave, Billy said, "At least I'll get a free dinner out of this."
Billy? Billy stopped and turned back. Take the job if it's offered. It's a good career move.
Opportunities like it don't come around very often. 3 days later, a hostess seated Billy a table at the Three Swans restaurant in Georgetown.
A waitress came with a pot of tea and sat it on Billy's table. Billy poured a cup and waited. 15 minutes passed.
Finally, an older gentleman in an expensive suit walked up to Billy's table and said, "William Burke."
Billy sat his tea down. "Yes," he replied. The man pulled out a chair. He sat and poured himself a cup of tea. "We should order." The man waved for a waitress. "I was told that you like Chinese food. My name is Hannibal Atkinson. Are you interested in working for the company?"
The waitress came and took their orders. When she left, Billy said, "Pardon me, but what's the company and who are you?"
"I work for the United States government. I'm the company's director of covered operations. Information about the company is classified and so is what I just told you."
"Why me? Why now? And why all the secrecy?" "Lieutenant General Law and Ambassador Popino spoke highly of you.
You have a distinguished career. You generate high returns on human capital.
You are dedicated to successfully completing missions and you don't get attached to those who you supervise. Why is the last attribute important?"
Hannibal sighed.
"The survival rate of those who you will supervise is under 15%.
"What'll I do?" "Initially, you will recruit for the company.
The Vietnam War is ending.
The United States military is discharging men as fast as it can. The company wants the special talent leaving the military before it goes elsewhere. The unstable ones will remain in Asia. The rest will come back to the States. Their files are sitting on your desk. I need time. I'd like to speak with Director Berti about this, and why all the secrecy? I can give you as much time as you want, but all the time in the world won't help.
Besides, Director Berti won't give you any advice."
"No one will. Very few people are privy to the company's business, and he's not one of them. Is the job deep cover?" "No, but you will only be a face. That means there won't be any information about you in any database or file, whether in the private sector or in the government."
Billy asked enthusiastically, "When do I start?"
"You have a friend by the name of John Mishler. I'm told that he's easy to work with and an excellent assassin. The company wants to recruit him. John won't work for the company. If he hadn't been drafted, John wouldn't have joined the military. When I met him, he was clearing ordnance from bombing ranges.
The CIA wanted his skills, so I brought him into Project 321. The CIA trained him to be an assassin.
It wasn't something that he would have gravitated toward on his own. No one gets involved with a project like 321 without being predisposed to adrenaline rushes, greed, and the desire to kill people. He'll work for the company. That isn't the case with John. He had no interest in being an assassin."
"John didn't want to kill people, nor did he willingly volunteer for Project 321.
I pulled him in by lying to him. John trusted me.
He didn't know what he was getting involved in, and he wasn't happy when he found out.
Mishler will be discharged soon. I want you to recruit him." Billy said adamantly, "I can't. John doesn't trust me anymore. Besides, he always talked about going home.
John plans to attend a vocational school when he gets out.
He will never agree to be an assassin, or to have his identity wiped. John comes from a very large family.
He has very strong family ties. Men like Mishler can't live a normal person's mundane life.
They crave the type of environment that the company provides." Billy sighed. "You don't know John Mishler. He's not going to die for the company. You'll persuade Mishler like before. The company wants him. It'll acquire Mishler one way or another. The company isn't going to let an asset like Mishler walk away." Billy looked down at the table and said nothing. "Mishler isn't going anywhere. Leave him be for now, but keep track of him. You have others to recruit. Pick Mishler up in a couple of years after he reacquaints himself with his mundane life. By then, he'll be ripe for recruitment.
In the meantime, I want you to check his family's background.
I want to know if they pose a threat to Mishler working for the company." It was a Friday night. Carl was watching television in his barracks day room.
The duty sergeant walked in and yelled, "Private Mishler, You have a call in the duty hut. Who's it?
The sergeant shouted, answer the fucking phone. Carl stepped into the duty hut and picked up the telephone.
Hello, he said.
I'm coming to see you. Where are you? I'm at Camp San Onofre on Camp Pendleton. Where are you?
Carl replied, up the road at Camp Orno. Ask the Marines for walking directions to Orno. The grunts use a trail through the huge open space between Orno and San Onofre. I'll start walking toward San Onofre on that trail.
It's about a mile. It was early evening when John called, but dusk by the time Carl met him. Carl told John, I saw you as I crested that hill back there. He nodded toward the hill. I knew it was you by your shape and the way you walk. You look good, John said. Taller than I remember. I was in 8th grade when you left. We're not ranch hands anymore. We're soldiers. I'm out of the army now.
I still have my military ID and look like I'm in the military.
That's why they let me on the base.
I'd like to stay in your barracks tonight and eat at the chow hall. Tomorrow I want to bang pussy in Tijuana. Monday I leave for Jeb's place, and then home to help Ma and Pa move.
How far to your barracks? A half mile. As they walked, John said, tell me why you joined the Marine Corps.
I wanted to travel like you, Jeb, Mariah, Mahina, and Booth. I wanted to see all those neat places that I saw in those travel brochures and magazines lying around the house. I spoke to military recruiters during the fall of my senior year.
They said the Marine Corps would give me the ability to travel with food, a place to sleep, and some money.
I signed my enlistment contract less than a month before I turned 18 and 6 months before I graduated.
I left for boot camp the day after I graduated. That's no reason to join. Blow that shit up someone else's pants leg. What was going on? Why did you leave?
Jeb, Booth, and I had no choice.
We were drafted. Jeb had just graduated from a technical school as a machinist. Booth was a security guard trying to get on a police force. I was working as a ranch hand. Mariah and Mahina joined to have their student loans waived, and then, only for the minimum time required to obtain the waivers.
They mortgaged 20 years of their lives to get their degrees, particularly Mahina.
You had no reason to do something so stupid, you dumb ass, and for 4 years to boot. You wouldn't have been drafted.
In an angry tone, Carl replied, you don't know anything.
Do you that think people care about or appreciate our service? I think so. People always say how proud they are of service members.
It makes me so angry when I hear Marines say that they're only in the Corps for the money and will run like hell if they have to fight.
I have a duty to fight. I mean, that's not why I joined, but I have a duty to defend this country. God. You really are stupid. People with money laugh at us. They sit at home, drink their toddies and enjoy their lives. Their kids don't come home crippled or dead.
Why do you think they continually say how proud they are of service members?
It's so dumb asses like you join and to stop people like Jeb, Booth and me from running to Canada. The public has no respect for military personnel and veterans. That's true no matter what they say or how many times they say it. Even veterans' benefits are bullshit.
The politicians are obliged to provide something, but wait until you apply for those benefits.
You'll see. My favorite is the additional points that a veteran gets when applying for jobs.
Employers reduce the points based on merit in order to offset the additional points given by law.
They don't want to hire veterans. They want their own kind.
Why didn't you go to college like them, be like them, and get a job like them? You dumbass.
My advice is to go to college when you get out. Remember that they're laughing at you and stay away from the government. It's not your friend. If you keep those thoughts in mind, you won't hurt yourself more than you already have.
Now, tell me why you really joined.
Fuck you. You think you know everything. You weren't there. My decision about what to do after high school wasn't about wanting to leave home. I had to leave, as in, get out. I stood in the way of Mom's plan to get off the ranch. She made it a point of telling me that I wasn't welcome. Dad never said anything. I was trapped in a shithole. The military was my way out.
Mom and Dad had no interest in helping me.
They never paid for my work. They didn't allow me to work off the ranch. I didn't have a car.
I didn't have a penny to my name and no way of earning money.
What was I supposed to do? How was I supposed to go to school, and for what? I had no interest in technical schools. I can't build stuff like you, Jeb and Booth.
I didn't know anything about universities, except that Mom ranted viciously about the heathens and communists in the schools, and their influence on Mariah and Mahina. I detested Mom and Dad's constant fighting, and all the beatings.
Mom took her rage out on us for no reason. The abuse was relentless. She beat us whether or not we were guilty of anything. Mom took to wailing on Yanni and Ursula just as she did on Booth. I wanted to leave in the worst way.
I intended to get as far away as possible and to never come back.
I decided to join one night after school in the fall of my senior year. It was a Friday night.
I was moving hay to the stockyard. Mom came out to tell me that we were going to Saturday night mass.
I told Mom that I was going camping. She called me a despicable heathen for not respecting the church's teachings. I said that I had enough of the church running my life. I said its requirement that I attend services was just as stupid as its opposition to abortion.
That statement caused Mom to go berserk.
She turned white with rage.
An old broken fork handle lay next to a hay bale.
Mom grabbed it and came at me swinging. I caught her arms.
She pushed me back against the tractor wheel and kneed me in my nuts.
I thought she had me at that point. God, did it hurt. I went to clock Mom a good one upside her head, but thought I'd have to deal with Dad, so I pushed her away. Mom cooled down when she realized that she couldn't beat me.
I walked into the shed amid shouts that I wouldn't be living at home after I graduated.
I heard Mom's angry rants many times, but this time was different. This time I knew that I was stronger than her. That changed everything. I knew that I'd never let her touch me again.
Tears welled up in Carl's eyes.
He wiped them away with his sleeve. I'm never going back. I don't care if I ever see Mom and Dad again.
Hey, I'm sorry that I called you a dumbass.
You're away from them. Don't let the shit that we grew up with ruin your life. It will if you let it. Let's get some sleep. I wanna roll out at 5:30 tomorrow morning. Which bunk is mine? The one in the corner. I'm the only one in here now. The other guys are on temporary duty assignments.
In the morning, the duty sergeant walked into Carl's room.
He poked Carl with his baton.
Get up, Michela.
This is your wake-up call. Carl didn't move. The sergeant poked him again.
Get up, Michela.
Carl finally sat up. He went to John's bunk and shook him. Get up, John. Let's go to breakfast.
It's best if we hit the chow hall early.
The food is fresh and there's a better selection. We can take a shower and get ready to go when we come back. Billy was sleeping when his phone rang. He looked at the clock. It was 6:30 in the morning. Billy reached for the phone. Hello, he said in a sleepy voice. The man on the phone told him, Michela was discharged yesterday. Now he's with his brother on Camp Pendleton. They're headed for Tijuana.
Shit.
Give me a minute. Billy sat up. He forced himself to wake up. Billy set his feet on the cold floor and rubbed his face to clear his head.
Finally, he said, I'm sending three girls from the service.
They'll keep John busy and out of trouble. I only want you involved if the police enter the picture.
On their way back from the chow hall, John told Carl that food wasn't bad. How long is the trip to Tijuana? An hour.
Good. I'll tell you about my illustrious military career on the bus. The Marines that I met said Tijuana has some fine pussy.
Have you ever been there?
No, Carl replied. The first prostitute that I ever saw was at a bus stop in Oceanside. I was waiting for a bus to take me back on base. Another Marine was waiting with me. I told him, that girl better be careful dressed like that with so many Marines around.
My fellow Marine looked at me with the most shocked expression on his face.
Don't you know what that is? What do you mean?
I asked.
The Marine shook his head in utter disgust and replied, she's a hooker.
How long have you been on Pendleton? A couple of weeks.
I just finished basic training.
They transferred me here for truck driving school.
So, you left home what, 5 months ago? About that, and I've made the most money that I've ever had in my life. Carl was beaming with pride. John burst out laughing. And yet, he said. You still don't have enough to buy good pussy. Carl said in an unapologetic tone, I go roller skating to meet girls. I can dance on skates, so it's easy to meet them. The problem is going out with them. I don't have a car or a place to stay. I ride the bus to Tustin, and sleep and eat on the Marine Corps base there.
I go skating on Friday and Saturday nights, and on Sunday afternoon, I hitchhike back to Pendleton.
John was watching Carl pack. God, Carl. Why are you packing all that shit? We're only staying one night.
Take a toothbrush, a pair of underwear, a pair of socks, and a shirt. Move light, you dumbass.
Carl told John, we'll lose a couple hours riding the military bus to Oceanside. Let's hook a ride. It's faster. The man met the three women when they arrived at the Oceanside bus station.
He told them, your target is the tall one standing by the plant.
The man cast his eyes in John's direction. The other one is his brother. Don't worry about him. The women looked at John and Carl. One said, he no trouble. He only want girl. The other is a baby. We take care. The other two women nodded in agreement.
When the bus pulled in, John asked Carl, got your ticket?
Carl nodded. Let me see it. Carl reluctantly showed John his bus ticket.
John told him, there's nothing I enjoy more than pounding a good piece of ass.
Pussy, here we come. Carl didn't reply.
When John and Carl were seated on the bus, John said, I saw my draft number scroll across the television screen one evening a couple of weeks before I got my draft notice.
My draft number was 6.
I was drafted into the Army on December 30, 1970 and assigned my military occupational specialty during basic training. It was Explosive Ordnance Disposal or EOD for short.
What's yours? I'm a motor vehicle operator, or I will be when I finish truck driving school. My school lasts 6 weeks. I'm in the first week. I'll be assigned to operate tactical wheeled vehicles and equipment that transport military personnel, supplies and equipment. I'll provide support in combat and garrison operations. My company commander said that I'll be permanently stationed at Camp Orno to drive for the grunts.
I'll be licensed to drive mules, gamma goats, jeeps and 2.5-ton 6x6 cargo trucks. I attended a 3-week course at the U.S. Army's Chemical School after basic training. From there I went to the U.S. Naval School for Explosives Ordnance Disposal.
The program lasted 6 months.
After I finished school, I was temporarily assigned to work with the FBI in Washington, D.C. for 3 months.
I checked buildings and cars for explosives. After that assignment, I was transferred to Thailand. My job was to clear ordnance from bombing ranges.
Later, I became part of a CIA operation that ran black ops. The CIA taught me to be a sniper.
They said the skill made me a more flexible asset.
I spent most of my time working in black operations in China and throughout Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos.
I blew up people or shot them.
The CIA told me what to blow up and who to shoot.
Special forces got me on site to take the shot, or to set charges.
Sometimes, and in order to kill specific people, I installed explosives in cars, buried them in roads, or hid them in locations like buildings. I designed bombs, which the CIA placed in satchels or suitcases. I designed magnetic explosive devices that attached to vehicles too. I also designed other types of explosive devices specific to a target's particulars, like blowing them up in bed, or in their kitchen, or in their office.
My favorite was killing targets while they used the toilet. I have 50 confirmed kills. All of them were high-value targets. That's in addition to all the people who I killed with explosives. Did you like your job?
I liked the technical aspect, like designing and making bombs. That was fun, but I didn't like the killing and I didn't like the people who I worked for. The CIA didn't care about me.
I was expendable.
I couldn't kill anyone, Carl said.
Sure you can. You just haven't been in a position where you've had to kill.
I hope you never are, but if you do end up there, you will kill without compunction. Anyway, Billy came with me on every mission.
He was a journalist and my best friend. We spent a lot of time together. We went to all the whorehouses together. We went on R&R and we got drunk together. God, we had fun. I mean the type of fun that a person never forgets. Billy stayed in Thailand after I came home.
I said goodbye to everyone in my unit before I left. The last person was my supervisor.
He knew that I was getting out and he tried to convince me to re-enlist. I said no. My time is up. I asked if he'd answer one last question. My supervisor asked, "What do you want to know? What is Billy's job, and why was he on every mission?"
My supervisor replied in a frank tone, "His job was to ensure that you didn't fall into enemy hands, and that included killing you if necessary." I was shocked, and by the look on my supervisor's face, he realized that he shouldn't have told me. Carl saw the pink glow fade from John's face as John recalled the conversation.
"That's sick," Carl said.
"Billy lied to me so that I'd participate in the Black Ops. I wouldn't have if I had known the truth, but finding out that Billy would have killed me was stupefying.
I don't know what I would have said if Billy would have been standing next to me at that moment. I doubt that I would have had the words to express how betrayed I felt. Anyway, now you know why the government isn't your friend, and to stay away from it. Government comes in many forms, but the outcome is always the same." "We're here," Carl said.
He watched color return to John's face as John looked out of the bus window. John told Carl, "Tijuana reminds me of Thailand.
I love it here. We'll have fun. It's still early. Let's look at shops. We can check into our hotel later. We should have an early lunch, say about 11. That way we'll have staying power. We'll eat an early dinner and hit the bars at 6. There should be more action by then. We should have the women out of our room no later than 12. I want my beauty sleep. I want to be ready to pound ass all day tomorrow.
By the way, if you want to keep your pecker hard, stay away from too much booze.
Believe me, fucking is more fun than drinking."
John spotted a bar tucked between two adult bookstores.
He pointed to it and said, "Let's see what's in that place." The three women and the man watched John and Carl enter the bar. The man told the women, "Go after him.
Make sure he doesn't leave with anyone and keep him out of trouble."
One of the women said, "I take care." She turned to the other two and said, "Wait for me." John chose a table more or less in the center of the room. He told Carl, "We're early. That's why there aren't any women." Carl looked around. "I don't like this place. It's sleazy. Let's go. You're not used to being outside of the United States. Is this your first time?" "Yes," Carl replied. "Let's go. This place is trouble. Here comes a cutie." John motioned for the girl to join them. "She's all yours." The girl sat next to Carl and put her arm around his neck. "Buy me a drink," she told him. Carl asked the waiter, "How much is a drink?" In a stern voice, John told Carl, "Buy her a drink." The girl watched Carl shoot John an angry look. She quickly slid her hand inside Carl's jeans. The girl grabbed his dick and squeezed it hard.
"Christ," Carl shouted.
"Oh, just buy her a drink." John motioned for the waiter to bring the girl a drink. Carl didn't reply.
He tried to remain calm as he struggled to remove the girl's hand from his pants, but she wouldn't let go.
She only grinned at him. The girl waited until Carl paid for her drink. Then she let go of his dick. Carl quickly pulled her hand out of his pants. He looked at the girl with utter contempt. She grinned at Carl as she sipped her drink.
John asked the girl, "Do you have a cute friend with a nice ass and big tits?"
"Maybe. How much you pay?" "I have to see your friend."
"Come here. I'll whisper my requirements in your ear."
The girl got up and sat next to John. He pulled her head close while he felt her breasts and slid his hand between her legs.
She squeezed her thighs tight against John's hand.
Finally, John whispered in her ear, and she replied, "Oh, need big money and 3 girls. That one, very special. No many girls do. Very expensive. Let me see hand." John pulled his hand out from between her legs. He held it up for her to inspect. "Make fist." John made a fist.
"Oh, need big money, for sure."
"Come with me."
"No.
Bring your friends to my hotel and no fat ones." The girl looked at Carl. "What about him?" Carl looked down at his drink.
"You take care of my friend?"
"Fuck and suck all night."
"Maybe."
"How much you pay? What's your rate?" "For you, only $100. "Too much," John said. The girl reached into John's pants and grabbed his cock. It was good and hard. She grinned at him as she squeezed. Oh, I do good job. Not just lick dick. All right, John said, but all night.
Can you take a big cock up your ass and down your throat?
The girl grinned as she jerked John's dick.
No problem, big boy.
She let go of his dick and slid up onto his lap.
You wanna try now?
John reached down and spread her legs. He pulled her panties to the side and rubbed her sex.
So now, I only need two girls, he said.
Leave to me. What hotel name? Misty Morning Hotel. What time come by? 5 o'clock. The girl slid off John's lap.
Okay.
See ya.
No ugly ones, John told her as she walked away.
Carl said adamantly, I don't want a girl. John knew that Carl was angry. God. You're a real pussy. I'll take her if you don't want her. Why aren't you interested in women? Carl replied, I'm interested, just not in the ones that you like.
John and Carl spent the entire afternoon looking at shops and eating, after which they hailed a cab. When their cab pulled up to their hotel, Carl pointed to the entrance and said, there she is. Carl, don't insult them.
Make them feel comfortable. They have to earn a living like everyone else. We'll take them to the bars tonight, and then back to the hotel. They'll keep the rest of the women away so we can enjoy ourselves. Maybe they'll take us to see the girl who fucks the donkey. Tomorrow, we'll get a different bunch and leave by 6.
My plane doesn't leave Los Angeles until midnight.
There's plenty of time to fuck the second round, and still catch my flight. John got out of the cab, and walked up to the girls.
The girl who met him in the bar grinned and said, hello, big boy.
These my friends. Big tits.
Nice ass. Yes?
John openly assessed the new girl's attributes. Your friends are beautiful, he said.
John walked behind the women and squeezed each of their butts as he stood behind them.
He put his arm around the two new girls' shoulders and said, I have a cab. Show us the girl who fucks the donkey.
The girl from the bar replied in a bored tone, why see donkey?
Waste time. All right. Take us to a good bar. The girl from the bar slid into the cab's front seat and told the driver where to go. The two new girls got in the back with Carl and John. One sat on either side of John.
One of the girls slid her hand into John's trousers. She pulled out his dick and began sucking it while John caressed the other girl's breasts. Carl had no intention of a repeat performance of what occurred in the bar, or worse.
He squeezed himself tight against the car's door and looked out the window.
The cab driver pulled up to the curb a short time later.
The girl in the front seat said, we here. She got out and went into a bar. John followed her. He looked around and sat down. Carl reluctantly sat too.
The girl from the front seat sat next to John and the other two sat on either side of Carl.
We stay here, the girl said. This good bar. Some bar not let us in. Some bar trouble. Plenty pretty girl here. You play tits and pussy. No charge. Slap ass too. Everybody happy. You see. John was thoroughly enjoying himself when Carl said, John, it's 11.
Already?
John turned to the three women.
Girls, he said. It's time to go back to the hotel.
Oh, too early, one of the girls said. Party not start.
John told her, we go hotel.
Then party start.
Okay.
You pay. We go.
The girl went to the bar's entrance and spoke to a man standing there.
He whistled for a cab.
When John and Carl reached their hotel room, John stood behind the girls and fondled their breasts.
Carl sat in a chair and ignored them. One of the girls asked John, what matter your friend?
No like girls.
Carl, John said.
Don't insult them.
Pinch their nipples. Make em squeal. That's what they want. Carl told John, knock yourself out. He got up and pulled a blanket from the shelf.
Ignore me.
I'm crashing in the bathroom. Come on, girls. Let him be. Let's have fun. He doesn't wanna play.
The next morning, John opened the bathroom door and kicked Carl.
Get up.
Let's get breakfast and catch a bus back to Pendleton.
I thought you wanted more girls. There's no point if you're not interested. I fucked enough women in my life. One less piece of ass won't hurt me. Ig dressed. Let's go. Hannibal and Billy were in Hannibal's office working when Hannibal's phone rang. Yes, Hannibal said. He looked at Billy. It's for you. Hannibal handed Billy the phone.
The man on the phone told Billy, Mishela's on a flight to North Dakota.
I'm on the same flight. There was no trouble in Mexico. Let me know when and where he settles. Billy handed the phone back to Hannibal. Let's continue, Hannibal said. Billy told Hannibal, I don't think Mishela's family will pose a threat to Mishela working for the company. Mishela's parents live on a ranch in Montana. His father is retired. His mother works as a teller in the local market. They have 5 girls who still live at home. One son is in the Marine Corps. He's stationed at Camp Pendleton. His commander says he's an excellent Marine. The rest of their kids are losers.
I pulled their military records.
One sister is a nurse in Miami. She worked in field hospitals during the war. The Air Force determined that she was psychologically unstable.
There was enough evidence to discharge her for medical reasons, but the Air Force needed nurses so they kept her on active duty. She immediately resigned her commission after receiving an honorable discharge.
She applied for veterans' benefits when she entered medical school. 2 years later, she was asked to leave for abusing cocaine.
Another sister has a small dental practice in Seattle. She was a dentist in the Navy and never got along with her peers.
The Navy placed a notation in her file saying never to readmit her. She was honorably discharged and immediately resigned her commission. Mishela has a brother in Alaska. He's homeless and hasn't worked since he was discharged.
The guy was a naval intelligence analyst.
His Navy test scores placed him in the genius category.
He was ordered to undergo a psychological evaluation twice.
Both times, the psychologists said he was psychotic.
There was enough evidence for a medical discharge, but since he tested in the genius range, the Navy kept using his work. He received an honorable discharge.
Mishela's other brother lives in North Dakota and works as a welder in a machine shop. The shop repairs agricultural and heavy equipment. He's married with 2 boys. Mishela's brother was a Navy Seabee.
He received a Silver Star for bravery and 2 Purple Hearts. He was honorably discharged.
Now Mishela's brother is a religious, right-wing fanatic who belongs to a local survival group.
Some members of that group belong to a local militia which the FBI has on a watch list. Mishela's brother isn't on the list, but he's on the FBI's radar because he's affiliated with members of the militia and because he has ties to patriot groups who staunchly oppose gun control and who have anti-government ideologies.
Anything else? Hannibal asked.
No.
Okay, let's move on. John was standing outside the airport terminal when Jeb pulled up to the curb.
John threw his duffel bag into the pickup's bed and climbed into the cab. He asked Jeb, "Have you heard from Booth lately?"
"No one in the family has heard from him since he joined the Navy.
I got a letter from Booth a short time before I was discharged. The return address was the Holy Gospel Outreach Center in Anchorage.
I called after I was transferred back to the States. It's run by a Catholic priest named Father Joshua. I told him who I was and that I was inquiring about my brother. Father Joshua said Booth was living and preaching on the streets in Anchorage. I told him that I want to send the center money to help Booth. I said I'd occasionally like to send Booth cash, and asked Father Joshua for help in getting it to him. I told him not to say anything to Booth. Father Joshua said that he'd help me.
Did you send any money?
Not yet. I wanna settle in first. I visited Booth while we were both in training. Booth told me that he killed people in his dreams. I often wonder if he still has those dreams. It would have been better if Booth would have had my job. His dreams would have been realized, and he would have worked with people like himself. It would have been therapeutic in a strange way. The work and the people would have allowed Booth to burn through all that baggage from childhood.
He would have been in a supportive environment where he would have felt normal and safe. Those crazy bastards would have reset his clock, and Booth wouldn't have felt threatened. Instead, Booth worked with the most anal retentive assholes imaginable.
He had to bury his worst nightmares to survive. I think that finally flipped his switch. Jeb said, it's better that he found the Lord, and is preaching. Maybe he'll go to a mental health facility for help. No one will ever get that crazy bat into a facility. Booth will never go voluntarily.
It's best to leave him alone and let him wander the streets.
There, he is no threat to anyone. I'm afraid that Booth will do some serious damage if he believes that someone is threatening his freedom.
I used all of Booth's ideas on how to kill people. The CIA thought that I was so inventive, but the designs were Booth's, not mine.
You can't imagine what goes on in his head. It's very scary.
He's capable of bringing down high-rise buildings and airliners.
I listened to him describe exactly how he'd do it.
His plans would work, and the social and economic impact would change how we live. I'm sure that many people would die brutal, unforgiving deaths before they found Booth, and hopefully, they'd kill him.
It would be tragic to see Booth spend the rest of his life in an insane asylum. Jeb nodded in agreement. How are Mariah and Mahina? Are they married? No, Jeb replied.
Mahina lives in Seattle with her girlfriend.
I never met her, but she seems nice enough. I call Mahina about once a month, and we talk. They are slowly building Mahina's dental practice. Mahina didn't have any money to buy a practice when she got out.
She used all of her savings, plus the government waiver, to pay off her student loans.
Mahina's experience in the Navy cured her of working for anyone.
And Mariah? She had a rough go after her discharge. Mariah's experience in Vietnam was far worse than the rest of ours combined.
Working in those field hospitals really screwed her up.
John said, Booth is messed up because Ma beat the crap out of him.
When I went to see him while we were in training, Booth told me that Ma threatened to cut off his nuts.
Mariah left the Catholic Church.
She wasn't able to reconcile all the death and brutality with what the nuns taught her in the convent.
Ma views Mariah's decision to leave the church as the devil's work, and an attack on Ma's faith, particularly after Mariah's convent training.
They don't talk anymore.
Ma can't accept Mariah's views on everything from death, to abortion, to gays, and to pretty much everything in between. It doesn't help that the Monsignor regularly has Sunday dinner with Ma and Pa.
And, it was good that no one was present to witness the event when Mariah told Ma. It was pretty ugly the way Mariah described it. Mariah didn't back down.
She's a petite girl with a gentle soul, but Mariah has the heart of a lion.
Mariah and Booth are similar in that both are exceptionally intelligent and deeply spiritual. Neither would allow Ma to control them. I believe that Ma met her match in Mariah.
I'm sure that Mariah and Ma's confrontation was equal to any between Ma and Booth.
John shook his head. That's sad. Ma would have tried to beat Mariah, and Mariah would never have tolerated that. I always knew that Booth was smart.
I mean, seriously, he's really smart.
He built the electronics that he figured to use in his explosive devices, including the component parts. The military doesn't have anything close to what Booth created, but I never knew that Booth was spiritual.
I always thought that his religious bullshit was for Ma's benefit, like he'd do anything to avoid getting his ass beat.
I thought that Booth tried to make her happy given that I had no intention of becoming a priest. Jeb burst out laughing.
I could never understand why Ma thought that you'd be a priest. Me either.
It was that goddamned church. That's why.
The priests and nuns were vultures, looking to take any kid, and Ma did anything to please them.
Jeb couldn't stop laughing. You're an asshole, John said. Ma wasn't planning to ship you off to the seminary. What's Mariah doing?
Jeb finally stopped laughing and replied, she works as a nurse in a Miami children's hospital. A medical school accepted Mariah on a full scholarship after her discharge.
It didn't go well.
After 2 years, Mariah's advisors recommended that she withdraw.
Mariah's demons wouldn't leave her alone. When I picked her up, I was shocked. You wouldn't have recognized Mariah. There was nothing left but skin and bones. I brought Mariah home. She stayed a year. We talked a lot during that period. The serenity of our place and playing with the boys quieted her demons. Mariah started to fatten up too.
Her personality returned, and Mariah got a job working with young children at our local hospital.
She said their innocence helped heal her soul. Mariah left for Miami once her demons were under control.
John looked at the sign alongside the road, and with a huge sense of accomplishment, he said, Minot, North Dakota.
I've been many places since I last passed this burg. We'll be home in a few minutes.
Jeb turned down a gravel road and headed west.
The boys are in school. Susan's in town shopping. They'll be happy to see you. I forgot how far you live from town.
For some reason, I remember you living closer. John looked at Jeb's house and yard. Your homestead looks the same. I'm surprised that you recognize the place. Jeb pulled into the driveway and parked. They got out and went into the house.
John sat his duffel bag on the floor and pulled out a chair at the kitchen table.
Jeb took the coffee pot off the stove. He emptied it and filled the pot with water and coffee. Jeb sat the pot back on the stove and put a fire under it. John said, I went to see Carl. I thought that we'd have fun fucking women in Tijuana.
Yeah, how's he?
Carl spent too much time with the girls. He wouldn't fuck a woman even if she crawled onto his dick. We should have kicked his ass more.
Hopefully the Marines will force him to grow some balls. Jeb told John, Carl's a soft-hearted idealist.
He was that way as a little kid. That's why Carl was always crying.
When you threw rocks at him, he hid under the manure spreader because he was scared.
Carl was afraid and ran for the same reason when Boo threw those metal can covers at him. You can't change who he is. The fact remains.
He has no balls.
If Carl had fought back, that can cover wouldn't have cut his throat.
If he had fought back when Booth and I threw those bull thistle blossoms at him, instead of running and diving under that barbed wire fence, he wouldn't have sliced his back from his shoulders to his waist. If Carl had fought back when I chased him with that bike, instead of running and jumping between the cows, he would have avoided being kicked in the head.
That cow kick really rattled his cage. John started laughing. Carl probably lost most of his marbles that day. The fact is, he's lost, and all that he can think about is how Ma and Pa did him wrong. I don't think he has a clue as to what he's doing, or what he'll do in the future. Carl doesn't see things the way that you want him to. That's all. He's not stupid. Carl wasn't going to take on a force that he couldn't defeat. Give him some credit.
His personality won't change, but how he fights will.
I don't know about fucking women. Carl probably has never been with a woman.
Give him time, he'll figure it out.
He has to find his own way. Fucking women was the whole point in going to Tijuana. I could have gone alone. I would have had more fun. I wouldn't want to be in a foxhole with him.
That's for sure.
He'd get me killed.
Jeb laughed.
I doubt it. He'd stomp your face, but Carl's not a coward. John grunted.
Jeb handed him a cup of coffee and poured one for himself.
What are you going to do now?
I'll go to Montana in a day or two to help Ma and Pa move off the ranch.
When they're settled, I'll go to Bemidji and apply for school.
They have an excellent 2-year computerized machinist program there.
I plan to take their welding program too. You'll never lack for a job as a welder. You should get certified. After I register, I'd like to spend more time with you and Susan.
I can find a shitty job around here to earn spending money.
We can go hunting and fishing. I want to see how your 50 caliber design is coming along. Did you improve the one that we built? Ever since I left the ranch, I've worked on the design. I made some changes.
I had friends in the military who were small arms and artillery repair specialists.
They helped me with my design. I researched alloys too.
My design calls for a lead core 50 caliber projectile with a tungsten pin and a full high-speed steel jacket.
The barrel is designed for tungsten.
I use a center-fired 20 by 102mm case necked down to accept a 50 caliber projectile.
My calculations indicate the projectile will pass through 1/8-inch steel 2 miles away.
John asked, what about the recoil? Those 20mm cannon rounds will crush a man's shoulder.
My design isn't for a shoulder-fired weapon. I designed the rifle to fire from a sled. The design allows the breech assembly to slide back into the stock.
It works on the same principle as an artillery piece firing, but on a much smaller scale. I built valves into the stock side that release compressed gas at variable pressure levels to reduce the rifle's recoil.
What about the noise and flash? I designed a 3-foot-long silencer that screws onto the end of the barrel. It's a pipe-in-pipe design.
The space between the inside and outside pipe is filled with foam insulation. The insulation acts as a baffle and flash suppressor. Are you planning other improvements?
No, Jeb replied. The 50 caliber is ready to build, but I need access to machines and material. My shop can order the material. It's expensive and my boss would ask why I need it.
If I try to build the 50 caliber in the shop on the sly, My boss and the guys at work would know what I'm up to.
There is no way that my boss would allow me to use the shop's machines, so I keep tweaking my design at home. Let's say that you had the money.
How would you build the rifle?
Oh, that's easy. First, I'd buy the shop's obsolete machines. I know how to operate them and my boss would be happy to get rid of the old machines. I wouldn't have to pay much. I would do my boss a favor if I hauled them away.
It'll cost the shop a good bit to dispose of those machines. I have a friend with a tractor and lowboy.
He'd haul the machines to my house.
I can use the shop's forklift to place them in my workshop. I thought it through for years, but I don't have the money to buy the machines, even at scrap value.
I asked my boss if I can have them. He said no.
He said it wouldn't be fair to the other employees.
I said the other employees don't want the machines. He said that doesn't matter. Eventually they'd want something else, or worse, they'd want money.
That could bring lawsuits.
My boss would rather pay to have the machines hauled away. That's a shame, John said.
Yeah.
I know.
I could generate enough work to run a small machine shop and I could use the money.
How much do you need? Jeb replied, I estimate that 20,000 would be enough to buy, move, install, and upgrade my shop. It's not much, but it might as well be billions. Jeb finished his coffee and leaned back in his chair. Susan and the boys will be home soon. Susan will start supper.
The boys have chores and homework.
It's best to stay out of their way.
Take your stuff downstairs.
Use the bedroom with the fireplace.
What are you doing tomorrow? John asked.
Let's go fishing. I'll tell you about the rest of the family. We'll head out for the lake after breakfast. Susan will have it on the table at 6:30 sharp. She'll wake you at 5:30. Don't be dragging ass. You'll want a good breakfast. We'll eat lunch in the boat.
In the morning, when they reached the lake, Jeb put the truck into four-wheel drive.
He backed the boat into the water and released it. Then he parked the truck and trailer.
Jeb walked back to the boat and told John, "Get in."
Jeb started the boat motor and let out for his fishing spot. When Jeb stopped the boat, John handed him an unwrapped cigar. I bought these when we stopped for gas. They're genuine factory seconds.
Before we left, I grabbed the butane torch off your workbench.
Are you ready for a light? Jeb replied, let me get my line in the water. John lit Jeb's cigar and then his own. So, what do I need to know before I go home? Jeb puffed on his cigar to ensure that it was lit.
Then he replied, well, first, Ma and Pa don't know that Mahina is gay and living with her girlfriend.
Ma would disown Mahina if she knew. Pa would feel the same way, but he wouldn't say anything. Only Mariah, you and I know. I'm not sure if Mahina told Yanni. Jeb reeled in his line and adjusted his fishing pole. He moved the bait box closer to him and recast his line. Then Jeb continued. Don't say anything about Yanni either. Ma is still at her throat. You'll just end up in the doghouse with both.
Yanni doesn't want Ma in her life. She controls Ma's access to the extent that Yanni can't keep her out. Ma phrases her nasty shit in the context of loving and caring, but no one in the family buys it.
It's emotional abuse, pure and simple. As he threw his line into the water, John said, keep talking. I'm listening. Don't say anything about Booth either.
Ma will fly off the handle about how she should have had an abortion, and then she'll lapse into how Carl's just like Booth. She claims that Carl ran away from home and left her and the girls to run the ranch.
Carl didn't run away. Ma ran him off.
She wants to sell the place and Ma didn't want Carl around to help Pa.
Pa doesn't wanna sell. What about the five girls? Bella graduates this year. When I last spoke with her, she said that she couldn't stand living at home. Bella said that she was leaving the day after her graduation.
I asked why she didn't plan to stay and help Ma and Pa move.
Bella started crying. We were on the phone. I didn't see that coming. Bella said that she didn't know what she'd do, but she said that she was definitely leaving. Bella said that she saved enough money to buy a bus ticket.
I told her to come here until she figures out her next move.
Bella thanked me, and said that I'll get a call one day to come and get her from the bus station. You should take Bella with you. Help her get started in school.
It's best to get her out of the house, but don't let Ma hear you talking to Bella.
Ma will accuse you of taking her girls away. She needs them to cook and clean.
Ma won't allow anyone to put ideas in their heads. John said, well, it's easy to see that nothing has changed.
Nope, except that Ma doesn't have as many people to abuse. What are Ma and Pa going to do now? Pa plans to work for anyone in the county who needs help. It won't be hard for him to find seasonal work.
He lived in the county his entire life.
Pa knows a lot of people. Ma's been working part-time as a teller in Sanders Market.
The market plans to take her on full-time.
Ma's happy about that. She'll get health insurance for the family. John said, it's sure peaceful out here. I won't miss the military. Yeah, I know what you mean. I never did.